I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. One out of eight American women can expect a breast cancer diagnosis at some point in her life, but treatments are getting better and more targeted. 9 out of 10 people diagnosed now live 5 years or more. Today we'll talk with the co-director of Johns Hopkins Breast Cancer Program. We'll meet a mother who thought her breast surgery would be limited to a lumpectomy until she discovered a family history of breast cancer she hadn't known about. And we'll speak with her daughter about the choices she now faces. Plus, the Komen Maryland Race for the Cure is Sunday. We'll talk with one of its organizers. All that on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks so much for tuning in. About 1 in 8 American women will develop invasive breast cancer at some point in their lives. That puts breast cancer just after skin cancer as the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women. The biggest risk factors are being a woman and getting older, although men are not immune and young women are not immune. But the death rate from breast cancer has been dropping since 1989, according to the American Cancer Society. 9 out of 10 women diagnosed live for 5 years or longer. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we want to spend this hour discussing detection, treatment, and prevention. A bit later, we'll meet a woman who learned after her surgery that her family had a history of breast cancer. We'll talk to her and her daughter about decisions they face. And we'll learn about this weekend's Komen Maryland Race for the Cure from someone who's helping organize it. But right now, with me in the studio, is Dr. Verid Stearns. She's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Cancer Program and holds the Breast Cancer Research Chair in Oncology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here with us. If there is one thing that you find that women don't know about breast cancer that they should know, what is it?
I feel that most women who come and see us at the time of a new diagnosis, one of the most common thing I hear from them is, but I have no family history. I didn't know this could happen to me. I think it's important for women to know, as you said in the beginning of the show, that just by being a woman and growing older, we are all at risk. So it's important for women to discuss this with their doctors and try to assess their personal risk of developing breast cancer.
And of course, that's what your work is. Do you find that you as a doctor, that there are expectations that you have to put aside, that there are, call them stereotypes that you have about who is likely to have breast cancer and who isn't, and that you sometimes have to move your expectations around?
That's true. I think we know of some risk factors, but again, quite often we see women who don't fit those criteria or risk factors, and this is why it's important for everyone to be aware of the potential risk.
And what's the best way to be aware?
I think women need to know what the risk factors are. So, for example, we did mention family history. So, of course, if you had a sister, a mother, a grandmother, or multiple cousins with breast cancer or some other types of breast cancer, of cancer that related to having inherited gene, for example, ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, those are all risks that we take into account when we consider familial risk. In addition to hormonal risk, so women who had their period in a younger age, who've had their first child at an older age or never had children, and women who had their menopause late are at risk factor. Women who had multiple biopsies over years for benign conditions are also at risk. So those are some of the things that we can make people more aware of. But again, it could be that you'd see me and you've never had any of those risk factors. One thing that women are going to hear more about is breast density. This is not necessarily the ductal cells where the milk is produced, but the cells surrounding those milk ducts. And density is something that we're going to be hearing about when we're having our mammograms. This is something the radiologists are going to add to the report. This woman has dense breasts, and this woman needs to assess whether she needs additional imaging with her physicians.
Yeah, tell me more about breast density. Is it something that... that a woman is likely to know whether or not she, I mean, aside from this new report, I gather Maryland is one of about half the states that is now requiring a reference to breast density to be part of the report on a mammogram. But just in daily life, would a woman know whether or not she has dense breasts?
Not necessarily. We know that younger women have denser breasts, but there are some either genetic or environmental or other changes that make our breasts a little bit denser. Women may also feel that the density of their breasts changes during the menstrual cycles, at the times the breasts are softer than in other times. But the density that we're talking about is something that the radiologist, the breast imager, sees when he or she reviews the mammogram, and a dense breast looks much whiter on a mammogram as opposed to a darker background, and it can both hide cancers that also may appear as white densities, but also just by having dense breasts, it seems that the risk of developing a breast cancer is a little bit higher. And we don't really know all the mechanisms behind it, but it is a risk factor.
So when you say that this is something that if a woman is told she has dense breasts, she will want to discuss this with her doctor. Tell me what that discussion includes. How does that discussion unfold?
So this discussion has to be individualized, but if a woman has dense breasts, maybe a family history, the question is a mammogram sufficient for screening, or should she consider another test such as a whole breast ultrasound or an MRI?
That seems like a pretty big investment of both time and probably money, may be covered by insurance, I guess, but also it seems like a worrisome decision. It seems like you're sort of asking for trouble.
And this is why you need to discuss this with a physician who is aware of the potential additional imaging studies that can be done and whether it's appropriate for that woman.
That is Dr. Verit Sterns, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Cancer Program, here on Midday on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. You can be part of this conversation. Just give us a call. If you have questions about breast cancer, if there's something you've been thinking about or an experience you've had that you think would be valuable for others to know about, you can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can call long distance, 866-661-9309. That's our toll-free number. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. There has been, Dr. Sterns, a lot of media attention around ductal carcinoma in situ. I'm not sure I understand what it is.
What ductal carcinoma in situ is...
Is
a very early stage of breast cancer. In fact, we call it a stage zero. If you look at those cells under the microscope, they look like cancer cells, but they still have a lining behind this group of cells, and this is why we call this a non-invasive breast cancer. And what it means is the cells don't know how to move from the breast to other parts of the body, such as lymph nodes, blood vessels, and therefore are not likely to be life-threatening. However, if you leave those cells within the breast, they could change over time and become invasive. What makes breast cancer potentially life-threatening is if we see cancer cells that originated from the breast in other parts of the body, such as lung, liver, bone, etc. So ductal carcinoma in situ, in general, needs to be treated.
First of all, how do you find it? It doesn't sound like it would be a lump.
So most ductal carcinoma in situ are found on screening mammograms by the imagers noting calcifications or calcium deposits on the mammogram screen.
I see. So I interrupted you. You were telling me how one addresses it.
So we, in most women, would still recommend that this group of cells will be removed. So we do a lumpectomy. We're removing the area, or at times mastectomy if the ductal carcinoma in situ is in multiple parts or big part of the breast. In general, there's no additional evaluation that is needed. If a woman had a lumpectomy, most times she will still be recommended radiation, although some women might not if it's a small, very low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ. And they don't need chemotherapy. They might be recommended a hormonal pill to reduce the risk of a ductal carcinoma in situ or an invasive cancer occurring in the future. But in general, it's not considered a life-threatening condition.
And how common is it compared to invasive breast cancer?
There are 60-some thousands new ductal carcinoma in situ diagnosed in the United States each year. So it's almost about a quarter compared to the invasive breast cancers.
Uh-huh. About one-fourth as common and mostly found, you say, in mammograms, in screening.
Correct.
Screening mammograms. And that reminds me, there seems to be, at least I think there is still, but you obviously talk to women all the time about this, confusion about when to start having mammograms, how often to have them. What is your thinking on that point?
So this is a very controversial topic. There are multiple studies that have been conducted over many years. The very first studies were we evaluated women who had routine mammogram versus not are considered outdated because our technologies have changed quite a bit.
And the mammogram more, technology.
Correct. And then the more recent studies may not necessarily have the exact groups of women we're counseling today. Just today, the American Cancer Society provided new recommendations for screening. And I would say that there are different societies or organizations that are giving women different and conflicting recommendations. We at Johns Hopkins as a group haven't discussed this new guidelines yet, and I can just tell you my own opinion, which is that until we have more personalized information for women, women should be screened starting in their 40s and have relatively routine mammograms until they're at least the age of 70 or older if they're expected to live a decade or more.
Okay, when you say relatively routine, how often are you envisioning?
So the American Cancer Society today recommended annual mammograms starting the age of 45 for about 10 years and then every other year up to the age of 70 or older for women with life expectancy of a decade or more. The U.S. task force a few years ago recommended screening to start at the age of 50 up to the age of 70.
So both of those start ages are later than I expected. I think I have read some discussion of telling women to start in their mid-30s.
So the recommendation by the American Cancer Society until today was to have women undergo their first mammogram between
like
the age of 35 and 40, and then have relatively routine mammograms starting the age of 40. Of course, women at a higher risk due to maybe a first-degree relative with breast cancer might even start screening earlier.
But again, summarize for me what you would tell. If I showed up in your office, what would you tell me about mammograms? Well, you'd look at me and you'd say, I presume you started mammograms long ago. But what would you tell a young woman who came to your office?
I would try to assess as much as I can her own risk for breast cancer. So if she has sort of hormonal risk factors or family history, I might want to start imaging in her early 40s. I would add that the guidelines, they'd say that doctors should discuss mammograms with women starting the age of 40 because some women might accept a very high chance of having a mammogram and a false positive, i.e. having a mammogram, something looks suspicious, you may have a biopsy. Some women would like to have as much information and are willing to undergo biopsies, while other women may say, I'd rather wait a few years and start at the age of 45 or older. So there are a lot of considerations that need to be weighed carefully with every woman separately.
You can be part of this conversation. If you have a question for Dr. Stearns, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You mentioned people are surprised about family history. Do we put too much emphasis on family history? People are surprised if they are diagnosed with breast cancer when they have not known of it in their family.
Right. So it works both ways. One is that I think a woman who has had a family history is really very concerned. This will probably happen to me. And we need to, again, put this in perspective for her. But women who do not have a family history or may just not know about family history, you'll be surprised on how many women are not aware. But once diagnosed, they find about an aunt or a great aunt or someone else has had some type of cancer. So women may put too much emphasis on not having a family history. Everybody should consider our own risk.
Well, we're going to pick up on that point in our next segment. We're going to take a short break now. There's lots more to discuss about breast cancer with Dr. Vita Stearns, co-director of the breast cancer program at Johns Hopkins. She is with us for this hour, so it's a great time to call with your questions, 410-662-8780, or by email, midday@wypr.org. When we come back, we're going to talk to a woman who has been there through a mammogram, through follow-up, surgery, chemo, and a genetic test. Stay with us for that. Welcome back to Midday. Sheila Cast here. We're talking this hour about breast cancer. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. With me in the studio is Dr. Verit Stearns, co-director of the Breast Cancer Program at Johns Hopkins, professor of oncology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. You can be part of this conversation about breast cancer, too. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And before we move on, I want to take a call from David. I'm not sure where David is from, but he's calling us. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious because I noticed how the promo situation here in the States pertaining to breast cancer in women and the Brits and some of the other European nations are not as thumbs up on a mammogram. And I just wanted your opinion on that. And I notice how you've expressed the need to do that periodically. And I just didn't know if they were not as pro on this. Why would the United States be so much into mammograms? And their concern is the damage that it does to a woman. So what's your opinion on that, Doc?
Thank you for calling, David. I was not aware that that United States policy is more in favor of mammograms in other countries. So David is asking why other countries are not and what it is that they worry about mammograms that is given less emphasis here in the U.S.
Most European countries do have screening programs. They may start a little bit later and a little bit earlier. So, for example, many countries have screening that will start at the age of 50, will go up to the age of 70, and women will be recommended mammogram every 2 years. I can't be sure, what's happening in every country. But I think one of the main issues that is led to the controversy about mammography, when to start, how often to conduct the test, is a question over diagnosis, whether we're diagnosing some breast cancer, many of those ductal carcinoma in situ as well, they may never have a consequence that maybe if we just left them in the breast, didn't know about them, they'll never be life-threatening type cancer. So there's some differences in opinion. Cost is also an issue, as you may know. Many countries in the European unions have socialized medicine, and cost does factor in, and that's another reason for a difference. It's also a very emotional issue for women, for societies, and lobbyists that also, I think, led to starting mammograms in a little bit of a younger age and maybe doing so more frequently compared to other countries.
David, I appreciate your call. Thank you. I want to pick up where we are now talking about mammograms to introduce Leslie Reese, who is an experienced real estate lawyer. She lives in Stevens, and she's with us now in the studio. Welcome to the program, Leslie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Leslie's daughter, Emily, is here with us, too. She's Director of Marketing and Client Relations for a sports management company, Clarity Sports International. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and I'm glad you're here. So, Leslie, it's been 11 years, right, since you since your breast cancer was diagnosed, and it was after a mammogram, correct?
Correct. I had a six-month follow-up for something that looked a little suspicious, come back in 6 months, and at that time, something was more than just a little suspicious.
And you were diagnosed at that point?
Yes.
And tell me what happened. How did things unfold after that?
Well, there appeared to be something that was there, and so I was sent for a biopsy, which revealed that there was breast cancer. And then the whole sequence of things unfolded from there. I had a lumpectomy to remove the tumor, and then pathology reports revealed that it was a fast-growing, largish-sized tumor for that short time period between when something from 6 months previously. And so I was advised by my oncologist, Dr. John Fetting at Johns Hopkins, that who gave me a lot of information to analyze as to what my chances were of survival to have chemotherapy or not have chemotherapy. I did not have anything in my lymph nodes, but because it was a fast-growing tumor, it was recommended that I have chemotherapy. And so that's what I did. I had 4 months of chemotherapy.
And it was literally while you were starting chemotherapy, right, that you learned about a whole other dimension of your situation. Set that scene for us.
Yes. So I had my lumpectomy, and then I was to start chemotherapy. And as I was getting connected for the first time for that chemotherapy, my mother was there and my daughter, Emily, was there. And the nurse just was asking me about any family history, which I had known about my paternal grandmother having breast cancer.
My father's
mother had died of breast cancer before my parents were even married. Mm-hmm. So I knew my whole life that I had a grandmother who died before I was born. But my mother piped in and said, oh, it wasn't just your grandmother, your father's father's mother. It was also her mother and her sister, too. So I immediately shook my head and was like, uh-oh, this is a larger family issue than just one grandparent that had it.
And then what happened?
So then I was sent off for genetic testing, which had only been in effect for maybe a year or two before that time. So it wasn't as likely that people would be screened as closely for genetic.
This was all in 2004?
This was 2004, yes.
And so your testing found what?
That I have one of the two recognized breast cancer mutations that's related to breast cancer. Mine is called BRCA1, and
what did that mean for you?
Well, for me personally, I felt that I had been lucky the first time to not have breast cancer that had spread to my lymph nodes. And every year I did have dense breasts, and every year I would have a mammogram and then usually have an ultrasound afterwards because there was something that they wanted to check, just make sure that there wasn't anything that was bad. And it was a lot of anxiety, and so I just decided. And then after I went through chemo, and it was not very fun going through chemo, and I had a lot of problems during the chemo process, I decided that it would be, instead of doing radiation, I had a choice of either doing radiation after I completed chemotherapy or get a double mastectomy. And
this was the advice you got after after your genetic situation.
Yes, I asked for my options, and I investigated what my options were with my medical team that I had at Hopkins, and I made a personal choice to have a double mastectomy and reconstructive surgery.
And let me pull you into this conversation, Emily. So what's going through your mind while all this is happening? You're close to your mom, I know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we were doing chemo, and I say when we were doing chemo because it's really the whole family. I mean, we all felt like we were going through it to a certain degree. We were focused on having my mother get better, and we were you know, looking ahead and seeing the next steps to get her feeling well.
And so you're thinking of that, but when she's getting this genetic counseling, are you thinking this could have some implications for me?
I mean, to a certain extent, I was in my very early 20s. I wasn't even out of college yet, and my sister wasn't even out of high school yet. So, you know, we were young and carefree to a certain extent and not really thinking that far ahead. But since then, you know, I have a child of my own now. I'm married, and it's up to me to sort of have my own game plan, because I was tested. I do have the BRCA1 gene as well. And so I have a team at Hopkins that has put together a game plan for me to figure out how we're going to move forward so that I don't get breast cancer.
You're sounding very much like somebody who works for a sports,
right.
sports firm.
Yeah.
Your game plan is what?
My game plan right now is, and it's been for the last couple years, is I have breast exams down at Johns Hopkins downtown twice a year, every 6 months. And I have a MRI every 6 months. I alternate between MRIs and mammograms.
Uh-huh. So this is sort of very careful watching.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we involve the Hopkins team in a lot of different things that we do. I had in vitro to have my child, and so we got the Hopkins team involved to discuss, you know, that in relation to the breast cancer. And, you know, we really don't do anything unless I sort of talk to the oncologist down there.
Dr. Stearns, that's something that that would not have occurred to me as a layperson, is that what Leslie has learned about the family's genetic heritage would have implications for Emily's decision about how to have a child. I mean, what should people be thinking as they're hearing this story? What can people learn from this, other families? What should they be aware of?
If you do have a first degree relative, a mother or sister with breast cancer, again, you should review the family history. And as Leslie told us, many times you just are not aware of more distant relatives until you ask. So try to compile your own family history. There are some populations at a high risk for having mutations. For example, the Ashkenazi Jewish population has a very high chance of having three common mutations in the BRCA1 or 2 genes. One out of 40 Ashkenazis will have a mutation compared to one in 350 individuals. French Canadians, there's some other small populations as well. So if a woman knows of a relative or multiple relatives with breast cancer and is part of that population, she could be potentially tested. Male breast cancer, as we talked about, is pretty rare and could be part of a familial risk. So any man that we see with breast cancer, we recommend a testing for.
We have a call from Liz in Baltimore, who I think is thinking about exactly some of these same things. Liz, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for taking my call. I was actually wondering if you could comment on when genetic testing is recommended for people without a family history for some of those higher risk groups, and particularly Ashkenazi Jews. I know I read an article last year suggesting as much. And I also was wondering if you could comment on breastfeeding, which I've heard can reduce the risk of breast cancer. And I'll take my the answer off the air.
Liz, thanks for calling. Dr. Stearns?
So in terms of genetic testing in individuals who don't have a family history, I would say that we don't have a final answer on that. It's something we debate a little bit about. That in general, we haven't recommended genetic testing to anyone just because they may be in a population that's at a higher risk. But it's something that we're going to be doing some pilot studies throughout the country to try and determine whether people should be offered the test. The one thing I would recommend is that the test could be available through your gynecologist's office, primary care office, and I know that many physicians will send a blood test, and so it's just a blood test, but I think it's also important to be done through a genetic counselor, because there could be implications to a positive test, but also to a negative test. If someone who does have a family history of breast cancer, but the test is negative, it doesn't mean that she's not going to develop breast cancer. So we need to be able to put this in context for the individual.
Would the implication of that be that there are other, might be other genes that are also in play here that we just don't know about yet, so they don't, we don't flag them in a test, but
correct,
there still is a genetic link? Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are a handful of other genes that we can test for, but they're relatively rare. But there are also genes that we probably did not know about, or their gene environment connections that we're not aware of. So I think it's important for the test to be put into context with the women's history, with the family history.
This is Midday on WYPR. That's Dr. Vered Stearns from Johns Hopkins Breast Cancer Center. Speaking with us, and also with us is Leslie Reese and her daughter Emily Reese. And you can be part of this conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Leslie, how has this whole experience changed your life?
Well, I think I'm trying to use the anxiety that I had from having cancer in the first place and from worrying about having two daughters who would be high candidates for getting cancer of some sort, breast or ovarian cancer in their lives, to work on trying to make things better for them and for everyone else out there. So my husband and I have worked very hard to promote prevention research. And Johns Hopkins has a program on preventing breast cancer. It's based upon the brilliant researchers that work there at Hopkins and the phenomenal high-tech equipment that they have there. And none of, you know, these two things coming together weren't possible for prevention research even 15 years ago.
So when you talk about prevention research... I mean, frankly, we don't think that much about prevention. Well, I shouldn't say that. I should look to Dr. Stearns for guidance. When you talk about prevention of cancer, what are we talking about?
So there's a spectrum. So, for example, if a woman has a very, very high risk of developing breast cancer, such as we discussed, a BRCA1 or 2 carrier, the lifetime risk of developing breast cancer could be 65% to 85%. Those are the women who sometimes make decision to have both breasts removed to try and eliminate the risk as much as possible. Women who are at risk because of other situation, either family history or also having hormonal risk, could also consider taking medications to prevent the risk of breast cancer. There are several hormonal treatments, pill forms, tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, raloxifen, that can be taken for 5 years or so to reduce the risk of developing breast cancer. We talked about watchful. There are programs that can be altered based on the woman's risk. Those, of course, are not prevention per se,
but early detection.
Right, trying to detect the cancers a little bit earlier through other modalities. This is what we have today. In terms of what we're doing through research, we think that there are some natural compounds that may be eventually successful in reducing the risk of breast cancer. Other research...
Natural compounds like what?
One of my colleagues, for example, is looking at curcumin. Another colleague is looking at a compound that's coming from the magnolia trees. We know women do not like taking medication. I told you there are medications available to reduce the risk of breast cancer, but we know that most women are eligible to take those, do not want to.
Is that because they have side effects?
So those medications, the most common side effects associated with them are menopausal symptoms, things like hot flashes, but not everybody is going to get the side effects. Some women will have significant alteration in quality of life, but most don't. But regardless, most women don't even want to try taking this medication. I usually encourage women at very high risk to consider taking the medication. I said, well, if you develop the side effect, we can stop it. But I find a lot of women are not even willing to start this medication. This is why we're focusing our research on things that women will want to do. And we know that most people want to take natural remedies and things like that. And then another focus is, you know, we talked about having a gene or having a family history, but we still don't have a precise test that will tell us with certainty this woman will have breast cancer, and we need to do something different than her sister who's not going to get breast cancer. And this is what we're focusing on, new tests, either in breast tissue or in blood, looking at multiple genes or proteins around the genes to try and help us in the future to really use prevention in women who really are the highest risk.
So you think we really could take the guesswork out of who's going to get breast cancer?
That's what I hope we're going to do.
Interesting point. Nice point to take a break and let us think about. We are speaking with Dr. Vita Stearns, co-director of the breast cancer program. Dr. Vered Stearns, co-director of the breast cancer program at Johns Hopkins, and with Leslie Reese and her daughter Emily about the genetic dimensions of breast cancer. We could speak with you too if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about breast cancer during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Dr. Vered Stearns of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, co-director of the breast cancer program there, is with us. And also Leslie Reese, a lawyer and breast cancer survivor, and her daughter, Emily Reese. Leslie, there was a point you wanted to make.
Yeah, the point I wanted to just add was that not everyone is eligible, depending upon the type of cancer that they had, for to be able to take a medication that would possibly help them and provide some protection going forward if they were even to agree to take that. My particular type of breast cancer that I had was not hormone receptive, so the medication that's based upon hormone therapy would not have been effective for me going forward. That was another one of the reasons why I elected to have a double mastectomy at that time, because there was nothing available. So I just felt like I was kind of a sitting duck for waiting for bad stuff to happen.
Mm-hmm. And the research that you're involved in supporting is aimed at some of the things Dr. Stearns talked about, but also I gather something like a vaccine against cancer?
Well, at Johns Hopkins, there is work underway for research on vaccines that would prevent people from getting breast cancer. There's so much research there on all kinds of things, most of which I'm really grateful for because I benefited for wonderful treatment and chemotherapy. But as a person who went through that experience and as a mother of two daughters, I don't want them to have to go through all that I went through with 9 surgeries and chemotherapy and blood transfusions and scarring of my body. I don't want my daughters or anybody else to have to go through that. So now we're at a place where there's hope in the future for the convergence of researchers and equipment to work on these things that Dr. Stearns mentioned for prevention. But unfortunately, government funding and pharmaceutical funding is not at the place yet because prevention research has not gotten the attention of those sources yet. When the research becomes more indicative of the fact that maybe drug companies could make money off of then maybe they will be supporting it. So that's our goal, is to have small programs, small studies that could show promise for the future so that we could get larger sources, so that we can get funding for prevention research. You know, we all hear about keeping in good health, eating better, exercising. Those things are all important, but there are other things medically that could be done if we can find what those keys are.
Let's hear from some of our callers. Andrea in Towson has joined us. Andrea, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask if what the research shows, the link between birth control and breast cancer, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Andrea. And let me, before I throw that to Dr. Stearns, ask Sue in Springfield, Virginia, to give us her question. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, there's two questions. My family is from Eastern European Jewish descent, and my mother, my sister, and I all had difficulty with nursing, with pain and extreme sensitivity. My sister was only able to manage a couple of days with nursing. I managed 2 weeks with the second week exclusively pumping. And I want to know if the length of time or the method, whether direct breastfeeding or pumping, if there's any studies that indicate if that's at all protective, or do you have to nurse for longer to get the benefits?
Okay, so we have, thank you, Sue. We have questions about breastfeeding and the impact on breast cancer prevention. We have a question about the birth control pills and breast cancer. Can you address both of those?
So as I described earlier, we know that hormonal factors are very important in determining risk of breast cancer, and breast cancer is quite common in Western society. So you'd ask, what are we doing differently today than we've done in the past? So in the past and in other countries, women started having their children very early. They will breastfeed for a year or two, have their next child. So what you end up with
breastfeed again.
Exactly. So you end up with very few uninterrupted cycles, right?
A lot of most of their time
they don't have regular menstrual cycles because of the pregnancies and lactation and so on. And what most women in Western society do today is have their children a little bit later, breastfeed for a relatively short period of time, and then wait, you know, a couple of years, may have just one child, two or three. So it's a very different hormonal environment than women lived in some years ago or still may live in some other countries. So we don't have the same protection that we might have. We think that lactation, so breast going through a pregnancy and lactation, there are some changes in the ductal cells that may reduce the risk of developing cancer in those cells. And cells that have never gone through this evolution, through the changes in hormones during pregnancy and lactation, may have a higher risk of undergoing mutations or mistakes in the DNA that will lead to subsequent cancer. This is some of the theory behind it. In terms of oral contraceptive or birth control pills, the risk of breast cancer is slightly higher while taking the medication. So when you're still taking the oral contraceptive, it's about a 1.3-1.4-fold increase of developing breast cancer. For most women, it's not a much higher risk than the baseline, but of course, women at a higher risk should discuss this with their gynecologists.
But you just described it, if I heard correctly a minute ago, as while they are taking the pills.
Correct.
The risk goes back to a normal risk
after stopping the pills for a period of time. That's true.
How long a period?
So I think for most women, it's relatively safe to take the medications when they take it in their teens, 20s, and 30s, and then they should consider their risks as they get a little bit older. And we didn't talk about, but estrogen therapy or taking hormones during menopause is also something that should be discussed and balanced with the risk of breast cancer. And most women should take it for only a short period of time.
Not you should not think this is the new normal for me is to be on hormone replacement therapy.
Right. I think it used to be that we thought this might be good for women, for their heart, for their appearance, and women would stay on hormonal therapies for 10, 15, 20 years. But now we really try to minimize it. So women who have a lot of menopausal symptoms, hot flashes and so on, might benefit from short-term hormones. And for most women, I would not recommend it for more than 5 or 7 years and to try and take the lowest possible dose.
One of the ways we can tell that it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month is the Race for the Cure. This weekend, thousands of cancer survivors and their supporters will spend some time walking, running, raising money to find a cure for breast cancer. The Komen, Maryland Race for the Cure takes place in Hunt Valley on Sunday, the 25th. And we invite Kim, I'm going to screw up your name, Kim Schmulowitz?
Schmulowitz, you got
Schmulowitz.
It.
Schmulowitz. Kim Schmulowitz, Communications and Development Director for Komen, Maryland, to tell us more. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this is will be in Hunt Valley. Where exactly?
Right in front of the Hunt Valley Town Center, so near the corner of Schwann and McCormick Roads.
And when do people, can people register on race day, or do they need to register in advance?
They can register both. There's a lot of options, actually. They can register online until Saturday at 1 p.m. at www.comanmd.org/2015. We also have walk-up registration at Hunt Valley Town Center in the former Carvel store beginning tomorrow through Saturday. There's a variety of hours. They can check the website for that. And then we also have registration on race morning.
On race morning?
Yes.
And describe the race itself.
The race is an iconic fundraiser. This is our 23rd year, and it's one of the top five charitable events in the state. We expect about 15,000 registered participants and 5,000 spectators. So it's a huge day of celebration and fun and camaraderie for women and their families and other co-survivors who have been touched by breast cancer. In addition to, of course, the run, there actually about 80% of the people walk the 5K. So there's teams that come together and walk, and we also have a big festival in Race Village with music and food trucks and fun and dancing and activities for survivors and kids. So it's just a really great day for breast cancer survivors and their families.
And the funds raised go for what?
75% of the funds raised stay here in Maryland for breast support programs in the local community, providing support for screening and treatment and meals and transportation for people undergoing breast cancer. Then the remaining 25% are pooled with other Komen affiliates and are put towards national research. And we have 26 research grants in Maryland totaling $17 million. Dr. Stearns is one of our Komen researcher and receives Komen funds for her work.
And tell us the website again.
It's www.comanmd.org/2015.
Okay. We're almost out of time. I think we can squeeze in one more call from Betsy in Baltimore. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm, very
at
quickly. Very quickly.
Okay, at the age of 20, I was scalded with water. My bra melted onto my breast. I was treated for first, second, and third degree burns, which healed about a month later.
Oh, my.
5 years later, I attempted to breastfeed, and my ducts became clogged. My breast was infected, and I had higher risk for breast cancer because of the injury.
And I know it's not fair to ask you to diagnose over the radio, Dr. Stearns, but just your first reaction to that.
Not that I'm aware of. I think one of the questions that you need to discuss with your gynecologist or primary care physician is whether a regular mammogram is a good screen for you. You mentioned those ducts and got harder and inability to breastfeed. So whether a mammogram is a good image for you, whether you need something in addition, and I cannot answer that.
Betsy, I wish you luck. I hope everything is going better now. And I want to thank all of you here for this conversation about breast cancer. I think it's important for a lot of us. Dr. Vered Stearns of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, co-director of the breast cancer program there. Leslie Reese, a lawyer and breast cancer survivor. Her daughter, Emily Reese, communications and marketing director for what's the name of your sports firm?
Clarity Sports.
Clarity
we represent
Sports.
Football players.
Clarity Sports International. And Kim Schmelowitz from the Komen Maryland Race for the Cure. I thank you all. And I thank you, listeners, for being part of this conversation. Up next is Here and Now. And join us tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about child care costs. How much are you spending on daycare? Are child care costs burdening your budget? We look at how the cost of child care in Maryland stacks up in other states. That's midday tomorrow, noon to one. Be with us then. I'm Sheila Cast.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell.
Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.